Welcome to another episode of Toward a Better World. My guest this week is Tim Packer, the executive director of The Cove, a nonprofit that provides a safe space for youth experiencing homelessness to access the resources they need to thrive. Our conversation revolves around youth homelessness, which made me wrestle with the question, what does it mean to be homeless? And working backwards, what is a home? We may understand the distinction between the somewhat clinical word house and the warmth of the word home at a deep but perhaps inarticulable level. So what does the concept of home really entail? I think of a somewhat kitschy print my grandmother had framed in her kitchen. A house is made of brick and stone. A home is made of love alone. To get more applicable, what needs of a child are met within a home? And for those kids whose core needs are not being met, what can we as a community do to help bridge that gap? As it relates to the definition of home, the first thought that I imagine many of us default to is simply a place to sleep at night. No doubt that is part of the definition, perhaps the most critical. But is that it? Is a home merely a place to lay your head for several hours each night? I've stayed in many hotel rooms that technically meet that criteria, and yet I would never attribute the word home. If I really stop and think about what my childhood home provided, it was first and foremost a safe place, a place where I felt loved and supported for who I was, a place where I was seen, where I was fed, where I could rest, where I was around people that I loved and that I knew loved me, where I was encouraged and held accountable for my schoolwork, where I had clean clothes and a sense of community and belonging. Now imagine those things being stripped away. Imagine their absence, or worse, imagine their opposite. Replace safety with danger, love and support with derision, rest with anxiety, food with hunger, and community with isolation. For many of the youth that are supported by The Cove, this is their reality. While most, but not all, of the young people supported by The Cove may have a place to sleep at night in a technical sense, many lack the support structure so perfectly embodied in the word home. I believe each of us shares in the responsibility of creating a home, whether for our children or the children of our community. My hope is that Tim's wisdom demonstrates for us how we may help with that mighty responsibility. All right, well, Tim, I really appreciate you taking time today and for the tour that I got to have of The Cove as well. It's a beautiful facility that you have here, so I'm excited to be talking with you. So I do want to get a little bit of background on you, but before I do that, I was wondering if you would first just, if we could dive in with you giving us an overview of The Cove.
Yeah, certainly. Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. I love the opportunities to talk about the work that we do here at The Cove and why we do this work as well. And so The Cove is a nonprofit working in the heart of Texas, so the six county regions, including McLennan County. The Cove started in 2016 it was co-founded by Dr. Cheryl Pooler, who now teaches at the Garland School of Social Work, and other members of the community who recognized that there was this need for a wider wraparound support for students experiencing homelessness. And so whilst there's legislation that provides, in the US, that provides some protection for young people, it's not sufficient or enough, particularly around their educational needs, but also having positive mentorship. I'm not going to say official mentoring, but positive role model adults in their lives. So we work with high schoolers, so rising ninth, so eighth graders who are going into ninth grade and up. We provide a number of core services, primarily around helping young people succeed through their high school education and then make a positive transition into their early adulthood. We have an after-school program, and that was how the Cove started, was with an after-school program. And that is really thinking about helping young people's educational attainment, but also meeting their basic needs. So shower, laundry facilities, food, access to clothing, hygiene items, etc. On that, over the last few years, we've been building the case management side. So one-to-one directed support with young people, both here on at our facility, but also on campuses. So the high school campuses or alternative school campuses within Waco ISD, but also Midway and La Vega. And we've served students from at least 10 school districts in the heart of Texas region. We're also a drop-in center, so Monday through Friday, youth can essentially show up at the door and access emergency housing or support to access emergency housing, those basic need facilities, but then also any other assistance that they need. Frequently, the youth that use the drop-in service are those who are at the more extreme ends of homelessness. And unfortunately, that often comes connections with Child Protective Services, Waco PD, mental health crisis outreach teams, and such like. We also have a tutoring service. And so after school and on campus, we have paid tutors that will work with our students to help with catching up work that's been missed, or to augment the work that the school is doing already on learning. And then lastly, this coming Monday, which will be the 19th of August, depending on when this is released, but on the 19th of August, we have a new role starting called a family advocate, which is about problem solving with family groups to help avoid problems becoming crises, becoming conflict. And our hope with that is to help families where young people are either immediately on the verge of being excluded from the home or exited from the home, or have already been had to leave the home, that we can help improve the quality of the relationships they have by helping them access some tools on how to have good problem-solving conversations. Last school year, we worked with 146 individual youth, largely from Waco ISD, which is where the highest concentration of need is. And the most that we've worked with in a year was in 22, which was 173 youth. And in 24, we're on track to likely exceed that. And the interesting thing about that is also that so far this year, we've had about 50% more contacts with youth. So we're seeing more youth more often.
So I'm assuming, based on your accent, you're from Fort Worth. That's my best guess.
Actually, Lubbock.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was torn.
I am relatively new Texan. So I moved here with my family. They moved in August 2021, and I moved in September 2021. And so my wife is actually from Waco. Grew up here. Parents are here, grandparents are here, brother and sister are here, and several generations of her family have lived here. Members of her family taught at Baylor. Her parents both attended Baylor. And we made the decision around 2018 that we wanted to be closer to her family, and that Central Texas was, for a number of reasons, made sense. And part of it was a lot of Anna Lauren, my wife, was having a lot of things popping up her life about returning home. And I was coming towards the end of my PhD, or by the time we got through the green card process for myself. And so I was at a juncture in my life where, like, do I keep doing what I'm doing, or do I find something else to do? And so there was a lot of things that just pointed to this, that being the right time to move.
Yeah. And originally from Scotland, is that right?
Yeah, so I was born in Aberdeen, but then lived in London and North Yorkshire for a number of years, and then went to university in 99 in Edinburgh, in Scotland, and then lived in Edinburgh until 21.
Okay. And so, where did you get your PhD from?
Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, you know, just in looking at your background, first I'd say that Waco is blessed to have someone with your rich experience, both academically and then practically, with youth that are experiencing homelessness. And so, you know, as I've been preparing to visit you, I feel like I have learned just through conversations with individuals that have interacted with the Cove, mm-hmm. that the typical kid that y'all help serve may look, their experience may be quite different than what the average person thinks of whenever they hear a homeless youth, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and that it is often a much more gray area than they do not have a place to stay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so could you talk a little bit about what that might look like?
Sure. So a common understanding or picture that people have in their heads of a homeless person, a slight segue, I would normally say somebody experiencing homelessness, and maybe at some point we can get into the difference between homelessness being an identity versus an experience. That's a very niche kind of area of homelessness research, but an important area. And so most people's minds would be turned to somebody living in a park, maybe in a tent, maybe in their car, but at the more extreme end of homelessness, and it's what Housing and Urban Development would call literal homelessness. Their category also includes people living in transitionary housing or emergency shelters. So they have no legal rights to be in the place where they're staying, and there's no guarantee that it's going to be there for a longer period of time. And certainly some young people are experiencing that. We were helping the school district with a family where there was a mum and their daughter living in a car. And so, however, whilst that exists amongst youth homelessness, it is definitely a smaller part of youth homelessness. The bigger part of youth homelessness is often what's referred to as unstably housed or unsuitably housed youth. And under the Department of Education's definition, well, it's called the McKinney-Vento Act, which is the legislation that governs the education of homeless youth. They would be considered to be homeless if they were unstably housed. So what that means is that they have no regular or appropriate place to stay. So that could be moving around from place to place, or couch surfing, sofa surfing, as it gets called, or the place where they're staying is unfit for habitation or unsafe for them. And that could be because it's not wind and watertight. It could be severely overcrowded. It could not have the required facilities, a lack of private space for youth, through to direct incidents of abuse or neglect.
Just to take a couple of those examples that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So someone that does have legally a place to stay,
mm-hmm.
whether it's with mom or whoever their legal guardian is, mm-hmm. but that place is not safe,
mm-hmm.
all the time,
mm-hmm.
depending on maybe, mm-hmm. someone's visiting, mm-hmm. or the relationship with that legal guardian, yep. is strained.
Yep.
How frequent is that a reason or an occurrence out of the examples that you gave that someone may come to you?
It's probably about a half to two thirds of the youth. And maybe not quite, half, because the other group of youth are, sorry, I'll just backtrack a moment. So you mentioned that about youth homelessness being kind of there's being some grey in there in terms of who's included and who's not included. One of the key distinctions for youth is also whether that legal guardian or parent is physically present with the youth. And so we talk about accompanied youth, where the guardian is physically living with them and part of the household experiencing homelessness, or unaccompanied youth, where the youth is responsible, or the person that's making decisions in their life isn't their legal guardian or parent. And so for accompanied youth that are homeless, often it's economic reasons, and we would call, they'd be in situations called doubled up. So they're living with somebody else as a family group because they can't afford or sustain their own housing situation. And so between that and then the sofa surfing, couch surfing group of youth, that's probably about two thirds of the youth that we serve. I'd have to think deeper about how to then divide between those two groups in that number.
Sure, but. No. And yeah, and really what I am always so interested, you know, with a place like this that is meeting a need that's so deep, is what is going on in the typical case that would lead, man, a sophomore in high school to meet some, whether it's DOE or, you know, whatever the regulatory scheme, some definition of homeless, struggling with housing, you know. And so I'm just curious about that typical case.
Yeah, when you look at the youth that we provide support to and serve here at the Cove, the vast majority of them, their story is embedded and deeply connected with experiences of poverty and combinations of chronic, unstable employment or no employment. We see a lot of single parent families, or where there's been multiple partners come through the household. And this is one of the things that in my thesis that I talk about is this idea of a pressure cooker, and that a lot of these families are living in these pressure cookers, whether that's individual factors that are contributing to it around substance use, domestic abuse, mental ill health, things like that, through to the lack of an ability to get and sustain employment that pays enough to cover the bills.
Got it.
So a lot of our youth, their experiences are deeply embedded in that. We also see youth from other areas. So amongst youth homelessness, youth who are LGBTQ plus are disproportionately affected. And often that comes from a lack of acceptance or arguments, conflict that has arisen in the home over their sexuality or gender identity. And it's a reality of our young people that is some of the latest data that I've seen on that is that they're 2.2 times more likely to experience homelessness than their peers. And so again, whilst that there might be issues around poverty and a lack of stability in their backgrounds, frequently there's more of a direct interpersonal relational conflict that's happened.
So you at the overview you talked, gave some examples of what the Cove does to meet this need. In walking around just now, it's incredible to see. I wouldn't have thought of all the different ways that you can tangibly help these kiddos that come to you. And so Would you mind just walking us through those a little bit
more
detail?
Sure. Yeah. So we have three major outcomes that we work towards with our youth. The first one is stability, housing stability and developmental stability. The second one is hope, which is hope in education and employment, graduating high school, but also helping our youth lift their heads to see that there can be a future for them beyond graduating high school. And so our relationships with TSTC and McLennan Community College and others are just integral to helping make that a reality for our youth. And then the last outcome is connection, so meaningful relational connections. And this is very much recognizing that human thriving is deeply connected with the quality of human relationships, and knowing that you have trusted others in your life who can provide support and encouragement, meaningful feedback. So all of our work is geared around helping make those things a reality for our youth. And practically what that means is for all of our youth, our hope is that they will graduate high school. And so the tutoring, our school supplies, the attendance recovery program that we have, the on-campus support, we've been doing a lot of work helping youth enroll. This is all geared around helping youth get to the graduation. And what we know from data across the US and actually globally is that graduating high school is one of the most effective protective factors against experiencing adult homelessness. So youth that don't graduate high school are 3.5 to 4.5 times more likely to experience adult homelessness than their peers. Other data also talks about the economic cost of that, particularly if they remain disconnected from work and for higher education. It's 2013 this data was put together, so it's probably changed a little bit since then, but the estimate is that they would cost their community an additional $930,000 per youth across their lifetime if they were disconnected from work and education by the age of 20. And that's housing costs and healthcare costs and criminal justice costs and all kinds of things. So everything that we do is aiming to meet those needs and achieve those outcomes. One of the things I often talk about when I'm giving tours at the COVID presentations is that something that homelessness does is strip away control, choice, and dignity from our young people. And so their ability to choose is hamstrung by both the economic and their circumstances of having to move frequently. Their control over the situation, often where they're staying, what they're doing, is determined by other people or systems like the school system or the criminal justice system. And I could probably talk about some of the challenges we have around runaway youth. Maybe come back to that. And then the dignity is that part of that is one of the first signs that a young person might be struggling with their housing situation is attendance at school, but quickly followed by a change and decrease in their personal hygiene, a lack of being rested thoroughly, but also irritable, and a change in behavior is often when you should go okay, what's happening? Why has this happened? As teenagers, appearance, social media, the idea of respect are all incredibly important for our youth. And whilst they may have drawbacks as well, it's an integral part of who they are as people. And what we tried to do is give some of that back. So tangibly, what that looks like is we allow youth to choose the items that they can receive from our pantry and from our hygiene closet, from school supplies. Wherever possible, we allow them to choose clothing that they receive when they're in need, rather than just handing out. We also try and make sure we always have the correct and the items that are going to best meet our youth's needs. So in the hygiene item and hair care products, 70-80% of our youth are Black or Hispanic and have very particular needs. And so we try and make sure that we always have the right products for our youth. And, you know, just write down, you know, they feel like small things, but they're big small things, and can be the difference between a youth coming back and engaging with support in the longer term, the difference between trusting the staff at the Cove as being helpful people that they can talk to and ask and receive help from, and also do they have fun here as well is a big thing.
Do you have places here where any of your youth would spend the night or have a place to stay?
So we're not accommodation, but we do work with a number of partners in the community: Methodist Children's Home, Behavioral Health Network, Family Abuse Center, Sally's House, Central Texas Youth Services. If a youth is 18 or is part of a family group, we also work with Region Education Center, Region 12, around providing short-term emergency stay in hostels. And actually Magnolia, we have some money as well from Magnolia to help us do that. So, you know, so we try and really work with the partners, but our focus at the Cove is very much on how do we help young people thrive into their adulthood despite their experience of homelessness.
Well, and that fits, you know, as I've been speaking with individuals about what you do, you know, I came into this almost exclusively with the thought of, you know, you said earlier, literal homelessness. Mm-hmm. But knowing that that is most often not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see, and it makes complete sense to me, to mm-hmm. see more of a focus on a meal, tutoring, mm-hmm. graduating from high school or getting a GED, going mm-hmm. on to trade school, meeting the need that it seems to me that mm-hmm. the after school environment that I grew up experiencing in my home mm-hmm. of having a little time to wind down, mm-hmm. doing my homework for a little while, mm-hmm. getting fed, mm-hmm. having some form of a community, whether mm-hmm. that was with my family or some friends, mm-hmm. and then going to sleep. Mm-hmm. And so that post-school, pre-sleep time, mm-hmm. it seems to be what, and again, I know that's not all of what you do, but it seems that you provide that stability mm-hmm. for kiddos that would not otherwise have that stability.
Yeah, and what you've described there is essentially what an evening at the Cove looks like. We are the program runs from about 4:30 till 8 p.m. School buses drop off youth here, and we also go and pick some of the youth up, just depending on where they're at. But the day starts with the evening starts with some downtime, then a community meeting. We'll have dedicated time for homework, other kind of positive engagement activities or a workout, and a meal. And then we will take the youth back to wherever they're staying at the end of the evening. So we have a driver on the team and three vans and a car, and, you know, and whether that's back to where they're family is staying at Compassion Ministries or one of the other accommodations, or out to one of the specific youth shelters, or if they're having to stay at a hotel, then to the hotel.
Okay. Yeah. Can I do a very abrupt gear change and okay. ask you some lightning round, non-serious questions?
Yes.
Okay. Are you British or Scottish or both?
Both. And I generally refer to myself as British, but here in Waco, frequently Scottish.
Okay. Do you ever say shan't?
No.
Now, I was going to say, do you ever say whilst? But
I do.
I've heard you say whilst several times, even just now during the
season. Yeah, I have. When I'm writing stuff, I have to remember to write while instead of whilst.
Do you look down on Americans for not saying those words?
Of course.
Okay.
No, not really.
Do you say y'all?
I do say y'all and all y'all.
All y'all is and the that superlative. That's good. What is the best American food?
The best American food... It's definitely easier to get good steaks here. I love the fact that it's so easy to grill.
Yeah, I see that. Like that. What would you say is the best British food?
Well, the best Scottish food is haggis, neeps, and tatties.
Oh, man, I can't believe you're going to haggis.
It's amazing. I love it, and I miss it. Kind of British fish and chips.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to get here.
What would you say is the worst British food?
A dry Sunday roast.
Okay. Could see that.
It's probably the worst.
Do you have your favorite British movie?
Favorite British movie? Several. The one that immediately jumped to mind was a movie called The Angel's Share. Which is about the whiskey industry in Scotland.
Oh, yeah, I know that phrase.
Yeah.
I didn't immediately go there, though.
Yeah.
But I know what you're talking about.
Trainspotting also is for some of you.
Well, so that was going to ask about. So, liked it? What are your thoughts on it?
So, Trainspotting, it's kind of a very brutal reality of what was happening in Northeast Edinburgh at the time. It's actually a community I worked in for 4 years. And so Trainspotting is set during the heroin endemic and it was awful. I wasn't there because it was the 80s and I was only like 7 years old, but working with the children and grandchildren of people who lived through that time in North Edinburgh, yeah, brutal.
I mean, it's definitely one of the hardest movies that to watch that I've ever watched.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, okay, so I want to talk a little bit about your thesis, and would you just, to tee it up, would you explain a little bit at a high level of what you looked into and wrote about?
Yeah. So the title of the thesis is Youth Homelessness and the Transition to Adulthood, How Understanding Life Stage Informs Effective Interventions. And this really came out of the work that I did in that neighborhood where Trainspotting was set, but in the context of having worked around youth homelessness and other areas of and groups of people affected by homelessness or housing instability, housing need. And the group that we worked with in North Edinburgh were early teens, preteen, early teens and late teens who were involved with high tariff crime, and recognizing that in that community there'd been intergenerational poor outcomes around employment, health, economics, criminal justice involvement, health, mental health, and so we were asking the question like how do you make a meaningful difference in a community like this? And the idea was to take what was called a total place approach, so you need everybody at the table, and break down some of the public sector silos and some of the community public sector and community private silos that were happening. And so we were focused around the community high school, similar in lots of ways to Waco High or university, one of the questions that was, I guess, plaguing my mind at the time was, in the UK, at 16, you're legally allowed to hold a full lease for a property. And in Scotland, since 2002, 2003, it's been seen as one of the most progressive homelessness and housing legislations in the world in terms of the rights afforded to people experiencing homelessness. And so if you were 16 and homeless, you had a legal right to housing. And the solution was to provide housing. And there is a lot to like about that. It's a good thing. It's the right thing. But what we were seeing, we often see, is that a lot of youth would have a failure in that housing. Either they wouldn't be able to manage it, they would get into arrears, they'd get into problems with their neighbors, the place would get destroyed, and they'd be back homeless again. And so I had been working in that area for a few years, but now I was also in this area where young people were also involved in high tariff crime and high volume crime. And so these were 15, 16 year olds with 100 plus charges already accrued, and for things like shoplifting, but also through to mobbing and rioting, aggravated assault, grand theft auto, arson, racial assaults, and then a few of them also ended up in prison for murder. So it was a high tariff, like it was a high level. And so my question was, these youth weren't officially homeless at the time, but were unstably housed, usually because their mum or dad in some of the situations, or grandmother, grandparents, were also unstably housed. And they had high levels of truancy and staying up till like 3-4 o'clock in the morning and not getting out of bed, all of these sort of things. And so I started thinking about what good would Scotland's housing rights approach do, and the models that we have for working with young people, will they actually meet the needs of this group of young people? Because once they turn 16, they can be kicked out of wherever they're staying, turn up to the city authority and say, I'm homeless, and the city would have a legal duty to assess that homelessness and then to provide temporary accommodation until settled accommodation could be found. So a very different legal context than we have here in the US. And so that's where my research came from. And initially I started out with questions of around how do we prevent this? What's working in terms of preventing poor outcomes for these young people? But realized within the first year that actually I had to ask more fundamental questions about what is it that works with young people and why.
What would you say was your core conclusion in those two neighborhoods in Scotland to that question?
One is that we need more prevention, particularly around early intervention and community-based support, starting from early years. So some of the content that Susan Cowley was talking about with Talitha Coombe, that is completely up my street and exactly what people in Waco and in Edinburgh and elsewhere need. That early investment in young people, infants and children, I should say, seeing school as an important place for children, and encouraging investment in the support for families in order to make attendance at school something that is not just tolerated but desired.
You know, thinking through your questions of, for example, key factors influencing young people's roots mm-hmm. into homelessness, mm-hmm. is it different here in Waco?
No, not really. In kind of Western liberal democracies where there are different but similar approaches to the role of housing and the role of responsibility in helping young people reach adulthood. there are a lot of similarities. The UK arguably has a wider social security net in terms of out-of-work benefits and housing support. Young people are frequently either excluded or offered a lower level of support than somebody who's a few years older than them.
And why is that?
That is a good question. Why is that? Yeah. And so there's a couple of reasons which I explore in my thesis. One is the perceived preferences of young people around what housing that they want to have. And so there's this assumption that young people want to have congregate housing, so flatmates or roommates set up, and that is the preference. And there's that is often what happens, largely because of the school to university to early career pathway that most people go through. Also, it's to do with housing. That's to do with housing supply as well. So a number of affordable one-bedroom apartments in Waco or in Edinburgh is limited. And so there are economic reasons that force that. So there's this perception around young people's preferences on what type of housing they want to have, which might largely be true. But for young people who are experiencing homelessness, it is frequently not desired, often because they've been forced through congregate setups and they want their own space, which one can understand.
What do you think that is done well in Scotland, in England, legislatively or through, you know, other social mechanisms, but especially legislatively, that you would adopt here?
Yeah, I mean, that we would adopt here. I mean, I think at a high level, having a unified definition of homelessness, I think, would be a really good starting place. And in Scotland as the forerunner, but in the UK legislation generally, is it worth me explaining a little bit more about the way that the UK legislation is set up?
Sure. I want to ask about that.
Yeah. So go ahead. Because a brief history of understanding homelessness. For a long time, homelessness was considered to be an individual problem. And so you get the poor law and other vagrancy acts and things like that, where if somebody was homeless, it was because they were lazy or stupid, to be blunt about it. And then in the 60s, Ken Loach, filmmaker, released a film called Kathy Come Home. And it was about a young woman who was homeless and was struggling to find housing because she couldn't meet the requirements of the housing providers. And this really opened the eyes in the UK to the fact that actually homelessness may be a structural issue to do with the housing markets and allocation policies and economic policies that were present in the day. And so around that time, you see some key organizations, so Crisis and Shelter, two nonprofits in the UK that do a lot of work around homelessness and advocating for homeless rights and legislative work and direct services. And so they were both established within the years after that. And then in 1977, you have the introduction of the Homeless Persons Act. And this was groundbreaking globally because it was the first legislation to offer somebody experiencing homelessness the legally enforceable right to housing that could be tested in the courts. From 1977, two things happened. One is the argument about who was included within that legislation or covered by that legislation has expanded and changed, but also devolution happened. And so what was initially a central Westminster government legislation since then has become devolved to Scotland, Wales, and then England and Northern Ireland are kind of essentially work very similar together. And it's to do with how the different either parliament or assemblies were established. But in Scotland, there was, in the early 2000s, very progressive legislation put in place as part of the devolution of that law. And so you have this the same foundation for the law, but then divergences in the nations. So, you know, thinking about like the story of the legislation of, around homelessness and the recognition of housing as a human right and the need for housing-led approaches to tackle a social ill like homelessness, coming to the US, having to learn about the lack of protection that people have, I think is, there are some things that could be helpful. A long shot, at least initially, would be an enforceable legal right around housing. You know, that for a country the size of the US, that's you know, that's a tall ask. But I think there are moves that could be made towards that that would help people, particularly around extending the availability of temporary accommodation and support to allow people to navigate through a crisis situation. I think the newer legislation in the UK around duties to prevent homelessness on cities and local authorities could be explored, and that could be around not control, but better relationships with private landlords around the security of tenure that people have. It could be about earlier intervention around mental health issues, not just intervention, but identification. So how do we better earlier identify that somebody is in a housing difficulty? We've had a situation recently where a family is in multiple thousand dollars worth of arrears and actually has been evicted. We could have done more, I think, if we'd known when they were 2 months rent behind, to help avoid that situation escalating further. You know, I think in Waco, there is definitely moves towards beginning to think about some of these things in the housing strategy and some of the conversations that are happening in the city and conversations around the continuum of care being the kind of collective body for addressing homelessness in a community, and the conversations with Prosper Waco that are happening now, both generally for everybody experiencing housing difficulties, but also conversations that are happening around young people. And so with the work that we do here at the Cove and, you know, with my interest in terms of my thesis, I think the having more investment in young people to have a positive transition to adulthood, and answering some of those questions around who is responsible or how do we collectively have an ownership of responsibility for all youth to succeed through that transition. So I guess to summarize, we would love to see an enforceable right to housing. That's a long shot, but steps towards it would be investments in communities around preventative services and moving towards having a duty to prevent homelessness, which means that we would also have to identify when people are at risk of homelessness. But also protect... continued investment around temporary accommodation, so to help people navigate crises.
So I had two more questions for you.
Yeah, sure.
One, is it too touchy to ask your thoughts on Scottish independence?
Not at all. I did not vote for Scotland to leave the Union. And that's not because I'm opposed to the idea. What I was opposed to at the time was the extent to which the people who would be responsible for navigating that transition were being honest and upfront about the cost of it. And it felt like the argument from the yes side was too utopian. Whilst I appreciate the arguments for independence around sovereignty, about the fact that Scottish voting patterns and English voting patterns are largely divergent, and the sense of feeling that Scotland didn't have a voice in the Union, I really kind of, I get those things. And the idea of, like, how do we build a country and answering those questions is, you know, they're intriguing, like, fascinating questions. I'm also not a fan of the government that was in place as the Scottish Nationalist Party. I was feeling kind of disappointed with some of the centralizing tendencies that they were expressing and showing in the ways that they responded to and dealt with local authorities. I'm a big believer in the idea of subsidiarity and having decisions made at the lowest level possible in terms of governance. And also just with the work that I was doing around housing and homelessness and families in distress, was seeing unhelpful interventions being directed from Scottish government at the time. And so, do I think Scotland could be independent? Yeah, I absolutely do think Scotland could be independent. Should they be independent? We've got some way to go.
It's interesting to read about the relationship between Scotland and the United Kingdom, because to me, that I see so many parallels in that. I think that one of the core struggles or conversations, if you want to put it politely, that American politics revolves around is, you know, exactly what you said, is who is the decision maker with respect to XYZ policy. Is is it someone at a more national, probably further away level, or someone here at a more local level? And so it's interesting to see in a lot of ways that's very, very similar to that exact conversation with devolution. And and if you would have told me that Scotland as a country didn't really have the right to make their own legislation until the late 90s, is that right?
Yeah,
99. I would not, until I was reading for this interview, I would
and in limited areas as well. So we'd always operate in devolved legislation and reserved legislation. And so it's one of the things I talk about in my thesis, is that housing legislation was devolved, but welfare policy legislation was reserved to Westminster. And so whilst there were some things that Scotland could do to mitigate some of the austerity measures that happened in like 2010 onwards, where the welfare system was really stripped out, and incidentally contributing to that pressure cooker that I talked about earlier that the families were struggling with. For example, there was a two-child limit imposed in benefits, and so if you had more than two children, those children wouldn't be covered by additional financial support.
Last question that I have for you. So when we were walking around, I saw a washer and a dryer, and I mentioned to a coworker that I was going to be coming here and talking to you, and she lit up and said, oh, there is a special place in my heart for youth,
mm-hmm.
and the premise of a kid that is hungry, mm-hmm. or the premise of a kid that needs help with schoolwork,
mm-hmm.
or needs clothes washed,
mm-hmm.
and has trouble making sure that all of those things happen on a daily basis just mm-hmm. absolutely breaks her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had contacted you.
Okay.
And asked, "Is what can I do to help?"
Yeah.
And the response was, "Well, actually, we need a new dryer."
Yeah.
And so to me, to see that dryer
yeah.
is really cool, because what I love about it
yeah.
is that you have people here in Waco that, you know, we all have different things that we may be able to bring to bear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you may be in a stage of your life where you can't or don't feel equipped to come down and spend
mm-hmm.
hours on a given day tutoring, or mm-hmm. vice versa. You may mm-hmm. not be financially in a moment where you can write a check
yeah.
that will help provide for your yeah. staff, but you could tutor. So with that background, knowing that there are so many different people
yeah.
with so many different skills or gifts or talents,
mm-hmm.
what can we as a community do to mm-hmm. help the Cove?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've loved about being in Waco is the generosity and the desire to participate amongst the people in Waco. I've consistently received a warm welcome around this work, and my family as a whole has received a very warm welcome in the community. And so you touched on financials. Yes, financials. You know, if you can and feel able to write a check, then that's great. Or if your workplace has a United Way program, you know, participate in that as they help to support organizations, which the Cove is one of. Yeah, we have a volunteer program. We ask people to commit to a semester, one evening a week, 5 till 8. And that's around helping our young people engage with the program, help serve meals, help with tasks that are needing done around the building. But primarily it's about being a positive person in that young person's life. Like I said, we do that. We recruit each semester for that. And you can go onto our website, thecovewaco.org, to fill out a volunteer form. And we also, throughout the years, have very different practical needs. So, like, I hadn't made the connection previously about the dryer and your work, JT. But, it just met a real important need that we had, and makes a really big difference. Yeah, we had a donor previously buy us the freezer, commercial freezer that we have. We've had donors buy bean bags, and we also have donors and supporters who provide meals for us, whether that's a donation or place an order with Wingstop or wherever it is that night. We have one donor who does birthdays, so every month we celebrate all of our youth who have a birthday on that day and decorate the place and have gifts for them, and the youth choose what they're going to have meals. We have one donor that supports that. We also have a group connected with St. Paul's Episcopal Church here, and they've been cooking for the Cove pretty much every week since the Cove started. During semester time, and it's a group of women. There's four groups. They take 1 week of the month each, and they provide meals for us. And it's a book group that was started by Judy Neville, who's probably is well known in the community. So we also have an event coming up on October 5th, which is fundraiser. So visit the website around tickets. It's going to be food, drinks, music, auction. We've got some great items, including rooftop suite tickets for Baylor, a hog hunt, a thermal hog hunt, no less.
That's very, very Texan.
Yeah, and if you like single malt whiskey, anybody, then a special whiskey bottling that you'd have to fly to Scotland to get.
So, that's awesome.
But yeah, lots of different ways, and we just love hearing from people. Stop, come and get in touch, and come by for a tour, you know, or just come and find out more about what we're doing. And you know, we love talking about this work because we believe it's an important and necessary work in our community.
Yeah. Well, on behalf of the community, thank you for what you do. Thank you for what the Cove does. And I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I've enjoyed it.